Thanks, Sharon, and thanks so much for organizing this conference. I've sat here for the last couple of days, both sessions, and if your head isn't spinning by now, it should be, from the standpoint of the different kinds of topics that have been covered, and it's really caused me, at least, to have a deepening appreciation of the different topics that Ray covered and talked about and had some expertise in. And what Dan was saying about Ray being a field scientist is kind of displayed in this picture here. We were out looking at that blue piece of equipment out there as a DMI unit, and it was kind of a new piece of tillage equipment that we were trying out at the experiment station. This is a Southwest experiment station, and we had just gone through this area with this tillage equipment. You can see the residue and the churning of the soil that's gone through. And Ray happened to be at the station that day, and we go out there, and he says, "Gosh, I wonder what's going on with this residue and stuff." And before I knew it, we had the backhoe out. We were looking at what was going on with different residue distributions through this tillage operation. And I think that moment kind of encapsulates a little bit about Ray's curiosity, about his desire to really look at things in a soil profile in this case and see what's going on from a visual standpoint. And I mentioned yesterday that I didn't first meet Ray in Lamberton, Minnesota, in the southwest part of Minnesota. I first met him back in Pendleton, and I was actually working in a no-till custom seeding operation in agriculture, and he was at the Pendleton station, and I got a chance to meet him a little bit. But the guy was something special, and you could see it just through his actions, etc. And my first week in Lamberton, it was January of 1992, and I'd just been hired down at the University of Minnesota in the soils department, The first scientist that came down, this is in January again, it was 150 miles, was Dr. Ray Almaris, and he was there one morning, somewhat unannounced. He had just come down from the standpoint of checking out this new scientist that was down in Lamberton and having a conversation. I really appreciated that, for one, from the standpoint of him coming down and making that effort. And that began a collaboration that was to continue, and was, you know, from the standpoint of my development as a scientist, it was very, very influential. In the library at Lamberton, and I suspect from the conversations with others at other places like Morris, we had these diagrams, these pictures of root systems that were out there. And again, this kind of displays, and you're struck visually with these kinds of pictures. And on your right, you can see a soybean versus a corn root system, and say, "Oh gosh, there's a big difference here, isn't there?" From the standpoint of organic matter accumulation, etc. And there were lots of these kinds of pictures that were around. Here's one that was looking at wheel track and wheel track impacts on some of these root systems. And you might, and has been mentioned, some of the root boxes. I found some of those root boxes at the Lamberton station, and the pins that you had to insert in terms of trying to stabilize where these roots were as you washed the soil away. One of the technicians that worked with Ray from long ago, Chuck Sands, that said, "You're not going to do that again, are you?" And he was one to say, "Forget that you ever saw those." But this picture shows a little bit of the wheel track. You can see in the middle, and this picture you can see it fairly well, but you can see on the left side, right side of the plant, there's hardly any roots that you can see that have grown into this compacted area that's created by this wheel track. And on the other side, you can see that there's clearly roots that have grown into the same area on the other side of the plant from the standpoint of its a growth through the season. And this is something, though, that impacts everything that from the standpoint of sampling, et cetera, because, you know, one of the things that Ray taught us is that you don't sample in the wheel track when you're going after things like soil carbon, et cetera. You're sampling on the non-wheel tracked row from the standpoint of sampling. And it brings about the the occurrence of when you look at a lot of different kinds of studies and start to integrate them, it really impacts the way you think and the way you go about your science from the standpoint of sampling everything to everything else. And I think this was one of the real messages that Ray drove home to me again and again, is that it's because you've gone through and you've looked at these different kinds of scenarios and through different eyes in terms of a scientist that you can come up with some really different ways and different approaches from the standpoint of how you go about trying to look at a particular phenomena out in the field. And, you know, another thing about Ray that was extremely important from my standpoint is that he was always solving problems, and a lot of his applied or basic research really had an application out in the field. I still use these slides when I'm talking to growers because they illustrate some really important points from the standpoint of what residue can do below the ground from the standpoint of influencing different roots. And this experiment was conducted in the, I think it was the early 70s, and you can see on the left, basically there's no surface residue that was applied to those corn plants that are on the left. There was 2 tons of wheat straw that was placed over the rows in that middle slide, and then there was the same 2 tons of wheat straw placed between the rows in that slide on the right. In other words, it was clear over the rows in that slide to the right, but placed in between the two rows. And what this really illustrates, and you can see the differences in the root patterns there from the standpoint of what's happening with root growth, just dependent upon where the residues ended up. And this really links back into some of the concepts that Ray and Bill Larson had developed in the 50s and 60s and so on, that there's a real difference between a row and inter-row from the standpoint of what's going on with root systems and how, in turn, you might manage those to try to promote some of the crop and agricultural results, performance. And, you know, if you look at those 2 tons of wheat straw over the rows, you can see that the root systems really haven't developed that well. And of course, Ray had gone in and measured temperature differences and water differences in these row and inter-row areas. And we had low temperatures, where the wheat straw was over the rows. And if you know how corn grows, you know that the intercalary meristematic regions are below the ground. And they're highly influenced by soil temperatures to about the 6-leaf stage or so. And consequently, you know, that had impacted how these roots had grown. And in contrast, where you put the wheat between the rows, that helped to conserve water in between those two rows. And that also impacted how roots grew later on from the standpoint of the season. And so you had a proliferation then of roots between the rows in that case where you put residues between the rows. And there's also implications from the standpoint of where you put mobile and immobile nutrients from the standpoint of fertilization. And this concepts that evolved from this were that you put immobile nutrients were placed near the rows, close to where those roots were developing at first, and then a more mobile nutrient that would flow with water, et cetera, could be placed in between the rows. And this is just some of the data from the soil temperature differences between that mulch and no mulch, depicting then what was going on with depth from the standpoint of average soil temperatures. Again, I stress the visualization of some of this data, and I've been struck with the root systems. This is also some of the work that Sally Lodgson mentioned in terms of the ceramic beads and the look at tillage effects on the distribution then of those spheres through the soil profile. In this case, here's mobile plow tillage, and you can imagine then as that furrow slice is being turned over and whatever was on the surface is kind of being incorporated in, well, it doesn't mix all together, and you can kind of distinctly see then the patterns there that were created by the incorporation of this material through a mobile plow action. And comparisons to chisel plow and no-till from that standpoint. Here's the chisel plow, and Sally was mentioning it's much more distributed in that upper 10 centimeters or so in terms of where those beads ended up. And here's some of the no-till, and again, a further concentration then near the surface from the standpoint of what's happening with the surrogate for residues. And You know, these are just kind of fundamental, very visual, and very impactful kinds of representations of what's going on with the tillage practices that really opens your eyes from the standpoint of what might be going on, from the standpoint of where these residues are, where they end up, and then implications in terms of sampling, other kinds of experimentation, et cetera. Also mentioned was the sampling, and I had the opportunity to sample with Ray, and we would get the gurney out here, and he had everything laid out from the standpoint of what Sally was showing earlier in terms of the soil probes and all the cleaning devices. And boy, you had to get that barrel of that sampler just shiny clean inside. That was a big thing. He'd be examining inside that barrel to make sure that everything was really, really, really shiny so that this would operate properly when you were putting it through and into the soil itself. Otherwise, you know, it didn't really work very well. If there was any kind of rust or dirt or anything inside of that, you couldn't shove that out appropriately without, you know, messing up bulk density and other kinds of factors. So it was extremely important to Ray, and you learned pretty quickly that this stuff had to be handled in precisely the right way from the standpoint of how the equipment was put together and how it was treated and maintained. Of course, there's samplers that aren't always using the equipment just quite the way that you might expect it to be used. But here I am sampling in the non-wheel track row, and this is in Waseca. And we did have fun when we were out there in terms of the sampling process, et cetera. And I treasure some of those times that we were out in the field and talking about all kinds of things from the standpoint of sampling, et cetera. A lot of the work that I got interested in with Ray was looking at carbon dynamics and corn-soybean sequences, and we happened to have some experiments that were at Lamberton that had been ongoing for about 10 years at the time I arrived, and then later on over at Waseca that had also been for some fairly long-term kinds of experiments. And those experiments contained treatments of different kinds of crop rotation or crop sequences of corn and soybean, and also at Waseca, a combination of those different sequences as well as tillage interactions, mobile plowing versus chisel versus no-till. And I wanted to share with you some of the results of those papers. And one thing that happens with carbon as it's taken up from the atmosphere, there's different kinds of carbon isotope fractionization that can occur due to either the photosynthetic pathway, some landscape level variation, plant tissue biochemical fractions, and then decomposition processes. And from the standpoint of looking at the delta C13 levels, which is simply a measure of looking at the heavier isotope C13 in comparison to C12, the atmosphere has a delta C13 of about minus 8, and this picture depicts the differences between a C3 photosynthetic pathway versus a C4 photosynthetic pathway. And the C3 plants include soybeans, wheat, et cetera, and through the processes of CO2 diffusing into the plant, you have a discrimination against the heavier isotope. And then once the carbon dioxide is in the plant itself, you have further discrimination that takes place due to different kinds of enzymes that are there along these different photosynthetic pathways. So it ends up that the plants actually get labeled differently if they're going through a C3 photosynthetic pathway like soybean versus a C4 plant like corn. And so consequently, that residue that's within that crop gets labeled through the process of photosynthesis and incorporation of that assimilate into cells, et cetera. And then those residues that are created in roots are returned to the soil, organic matter, and that organic matter becomes labeled over time as these crops are grown. And here's just a schematic then, a representation of the replacement of soil carbon derived from a vegetation A by carbon from vegetated B. So if you started off at time zero, which is that delta A zero from the standpoint of looking at time and that soil carbon on the left axis, and if you had a certain vegetative type like a C4 species that had been grown there with a certain kind of then labeling that occurred within the soil itself, and you were to shift that to a different kind of a plant from the standpoint of its photosynthetic pathway, then you would find that that I can use this, can I? You can find that that carbon then would be replaced by the carbon additions that were coming in from vegetation B, and you'd add up with then different levels then of labeling within that soil. And you could use a mixing equation like this to partition that carbon into C3 and C4 sources. And many of the soils, of course, around Lamberton and the upper Midwest, or the Midwest in general, have had a historic influence of both C3 and C4 sources. And so you end up then that particular soil has a certain delta C13 level that, in turn, when you impose treatments upon that, may shift then over time as you have something like continuous corn that's only having a labeling of like a delta C13 to minus 12 or so versus a soybean at a delta C13 to minus 27. And so you can see here this just then uses the delta C13s from corn and soybean residue and is able to look at the fraction. Then you can derive then the fraction of carbon that's coming from a C4 source versus one from a C3 source. And this just illustrates then some of the delta C13 levels that we had with a study that just had continuous corn versus continuous soybeans versus a soybean corn sequence versus a corn soybean sequence. And you can see then, and then some fallow areas. We also, you know, Ray, we were out there sampling these different treatments here, and then we're looking around, and you know, around most plots you keep fallow from the standpoint of just maintaining the area weed-free, et cetera. And we actually used that then as an area where we didn't have very much input from the standpoint of organic materials at all. And you would see then within that a different no additions, in other words, and you had just had the decay of both the C3 and C4 derived carbon through the time sequence that particular experiment had been out there. And in this then, we had sampled from 0 to 15 centimeters and 15 to 30 centimeters. And you can see with continuous corn, we're kind of going towards the delta C13, more towards 12, which is minus 12, which is where this is coming from. And if you look at the continuous soybeans down here, they're kind of drifting towards the minus 27 delta C13 levels. And then in between, you have the soybean corn right here, and then the corn soybean. And notice there's quite a spread there from the standpoint of these two different treatments. And this comes back again to all that tillage operations, in this case, mowbore plowing, where you're actually, in this case, 0 to 15 and 15 to 30 kind of influences then the residues from the previous crop that had been grown had been distributed down to the depth of the 15 to 30, and we're actually picking that up from the standpoint of where the signal is coming from the previous year's crop. It was that sensitive from the standpoint of carbon. And we could also model that carbon by just going through a fairly simple two-pool process that was derived from Jenkinson back in 1988, but a fast pool and a slow pool, and we could go through the dynamics of this by using those delta C13 levels. And come up with data like this, that in the fast pool, where humification constants and decay rate constants could be derived, turnover times and half times, and then carbon equilibrium levels that you might find under the current inputs of carbon in those systems. And so that was a Lamberton study, and then that we published back in 1998, and then we went on to go over to Waseca, which is where you saw me sampling there, and looked there at some of the experiments that contained tillage and crop rotation effects on soil organic carbon, which was published back in 2007. And this study was pretty interesting in that we had sampled with depth down to 45 centimeters. And you know, there's a lot of controversy right now, and you've probably seen data if you've been wandering around this conference that shows different results from the standpoint of imposition of different kinds of tillage regimes and what happens with soil carbon over the course of time. This is a 14-year experiment in this case, and what we found, and treatments consisted of continuous corn again, continuous soybeans, and then a corn-soybean sequence, and then tillage treatments of mowbore plowing, chisel plowing, and no-till. And what we found was a distinct interaction. This is for the total 0 to 45 centimeters in terms of total carbon. And again, combining the depth increments, et cetera, the bulk density data in order to give us a mass per unit area or volume. And one thing that you can see from these data are that the mowbore plowing pretty much had much lower carbon levels than either the chisel plow or the no-till. And also that continuous soybeans were almost equivalent to mobile plowing from the standpoint of how much carbon that was there, regardless of tillage. And that the fallow wasn't too far off either from the standpoint of looking at the carbon levels here under mobile plowing. So distinct interaction then, where the most carbon was found under the chisel plow and no-till continuous corn and corn-soybean sequences, wherever there was corn, basically. And so some of the summary from that research was that tillage effects on soil organic carbon were greatest in the continuous corn, where chisel plowing had 26% and no-till 20% more soil organic carbon than mobile plowing. And that continuous soybean was the only crop sequence where tillage had no influence on soil organic carbon inputs, and where the C inputs from continuous soybeans were 55% of that of continuous corn. And we also showed through that Delta C13 analysis that the soil organic carbon decomposition rates were accelerated by having the soybeans in that sequence. And that a large proportion of the greater soil organic carbon under continuous corn for both the chisel plowing and the no-till as compared to mobile plowing occurred below the tillage operation depths. In other words, it was in the 30 to 45 centimeter depths. And this is a little bit different than some of the data that people have shown. And I was thinking when we were talking about hysteresis effects a little bit later that there's almost an analogy there from the standpoint of soil carbon in terms of where you're starting from. And if you're starting with a system that has greater amounts of soil carbon and they're kind of declining over time still, and in this case, in this particular study, it had been a field that had been converted from alfalfa that had been used with dairy systems, alfalfa in rotation, as well as no-till drainage. And then towards the beginning, well, before the experiment started, they had converted it to annual cropping as well as tile drained it, artificial drained it. And the carbon levels, this took a lot of scratching of heads, but the carbon levels were actually declining over time still. And the no-till tended to preserve more of that carbon from the standpoint of deep in the profile. And it's different from a situation where you're grading, where you're starting off with a degraded situation and you're trying to build carbon levels up from that standpoint. Here, we're kind of holding on to more of the carbon that was in the profile by having no-till, chisel plowing, and continuous corn. And so that kind of tells you, you know, where you're starting from and whether you're going up or down, it makes a difference from the standpoint of what kinds of tillage effects that you might have, kind of like either wetting or drying of soil profile from the standpoint of hysteresis. I was expecting Dan Jimenez, of course, to talk about fractals, and he didn't. So my role here was, and this shows a little bit about Ray too, my role here was to provide first some land area and plots that were out there. And of course, through working with Ray, I got to pay for this laser microrelief meter, which I knew nothing about, but I took a trip with Dan over to the Purdue Soil Erosion Lab, and we learned how to use, or Dan used learned how to use this this thing. And I think he had some pretty good experiments that were ongoing from the standpoint of evaluating soil structure, surface roughness, et cetera, with this. And the scary part was is when neither Dan nor Ray could go to the ASA meetings and present the poster that they had put together, which my name was on, about third or fourth author down the road. But I had to stand in front of the poster because they couldn't make it. So I'm sitting there trying to read Mendelbrot beforehand to figure out what a fractal was so that I could work my way through this poster. It was pretty interesting to me, but it kind of illustrates that the kind of mind bending that Ray could do to you from the standpoint of getting you involved in terms of disciplines that you never thought you'd be involved with. And from that standpoint, you know, these research stations like the one I was at Lamberton, you know, I think it was Jane that talked about all the data that Ray collected and, you know, the tremendous amount of information and stacks of data that we collected. Well, the real secret behind that was that at all these experiment stations, there was a lot of people there. Technicians, summertime help, people like me. So there was a workforce there that Ray could tap into and collect this data while he was up at St. Paul. So from that standpoint, I was just talking to Jeff Vetch and laughing because Jeff was at Waseca Ray was there. Ray would have those guys working on various projects through the whole year. The same thing at Lamberton. We were always collecting data for Ray in one aspect or another from the standpoint of his research program. So it was a good collaboration, and I really appreciated Ray through the time that I knew him. And another thing that Ray did was that he celebrated with you as well, and at every field day, he was there. He was down. He came down to the station, and we'd have a steak fry the evening before field day and maybe drink a beer or two. And see Ray on the left there and myself, Dennis Fuchs, and then Jim Sturica and his wife are there too. And Ray was engaged, you know, from the standpoint of working with you, your life, and he knew that this meant a lot from the standpoint of our collaboration, et cetera, to have that type of interaction at field days, in the field itself. And then when we went up to campus and visited with him, his door was always open, and he was a great collaborator and scientist. And I think I'm it. So thanks again for inviting me. I appreciate it. Thanks, Dave.